The time I was doing it, I actually thought I was making quite an important record. Yes, I actually really believed when I was doing it that it was really quite a meaningful one. I really thought it was going to be good.
This week in the studio, Ian Anderson joins me for the fanniversary of a timeless classic.
As I did walk by Hampstead Fair, I came upon Mother Goose. So I turned her loose as she was screaming.
Hi, I'm Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull in the studio for the anniversary of Aqualung.
Writing on AllMusic.com, Bruce Etter says, and I quote, "Mixing hard rock and folk melodies with Ian Anderson's dour musings on faith and religion, mostly how organized religion had restricted mankind's relationship with God, Aqualung was extremely profound for a number 7 chart hit and one of the most cerebral albums ever to reach millions of rock listeners," end quote. Jethro Tull's lead singer and songwriter was this wild-eyed Englishman decked out in striped tights and sashes, looking like some kind of Elizabethan madman. But strangest of all was his instrument. Instead of an electric guitar, Ian Anderson's rock weapon was a flute. Anderson was from Blackpool in the north of England, and the son of a night watchman who quit school at 15, studied art for a while, eventually moving to London, finding work as a movie house janitor. In 1968, Ian Anderson founded Jethro Tull. They released 3 critically and moderately successful albums, and it inspired him all to write the songs for Aqualung.
A lot of English bands who went away and played in America came back wearing cowboy hats and fringe jackets and starting to write songs about, you know, grooving in good old LA and whatever, you know, started to try and pretend to be American, you know, because they were very impressed and infatuated with all of that. And for us, it was the opposite. I mean, I wanted to come back and do something that was much more British and was much more truly about me and where I was from. So it was an album that consisted of a lot of songs which were to do with things that I had felt and gone through in my sort of years of puberty, basically. I mean, sort of, you know, that kind of, you know, from 12 through till about 16, 17 years old, that sort of era when I was, you know, kind of testing authority a bit and going through a lot of, you know, fairly sort of, I suppose, typically youthful, aggressive standpoints towards a lot of things, particularly sort of questioning, obviously, the role of religion, which I find myself questioning even now. You've got to look, usually a very short distance from your own shores, to see where religious wars or opposing religions activities result in war. You know, it's just happening all over the place, isn't it? You know, under this guise of sort of, you know, religion, fervor, sort of identity and all the rest of it. What is it all about? You know, can't we just have a God that was like the one we were brought up to believe in? You know, it's got a nice white beard and, you know, sits back and smokes a Peterson pipe and pats little girls on the head, a kind of Santa Claus, a sort of Father Christmas kind of God. You know, he was fairly safe. What we end up with is this kind of, you know, a different God for virtually every religion, you know, and this terrible, terrible sense of it being an excuse for people's innate desire to wreak havoc with each other, you know. It's just horrific. So, I mean, the crazy thing about writing an album like Aqualung is that a lot of these things I wrote about, which were actually, you know, writing about what I felt when I was 15 or 16, I don't feel that different now. I mean, not a lot has changed, you know,
doesn't
in terms of the way I feel about
you now?
It.
When you were 15 or 16, didn't you think that all of this would be revealed when you got to be an adult?
Yeah, that's exactly right, which is why I think I felt if I didn't write that stuff then, I might change my viewpoint as I got older. I might, you know, and I'd better sort of, you know, capture these sort of fairly, you know, sort of fiery and rather naive views at the time and commit them in some way in a song, because if I didn't do it then, I might change my mind. As it happens, I think most of the things that I wrote about there, I mean, although they may be simplistic and naive, the essence of them is pretty much how I feel about things now. I really don't feel any different.
Sitting on the park bench, eyeing little girls with bad intent. Snot running down his nose, greasy fingers smearing shabby clothes. Hey, Aquila, drying in the cold. Oh,
Aqualung, my friend, don't you start away uneasy. You poor old sod, you see it's only me.
Sitting on the park bench, eyeing little girls with bad intent. Snot running down his nose, greasy fingers smearing shabby clothes. Hey, Aqualung, drying in the
title song from Jethro Tull's fourth album, Aqualung, released in 1971. Misfits from mainstream society had never really been dealt with as a subject for popular music before. Here is Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull.
It's the embarrassment, isn't it? It's the embarrassment of passing some, whether it's an old tramp, you know, being sick in the gutter or about to peg it, you know, or whether it's anybody who doesn't fit in, who isn't the sort of social norm. You know, we sort of feel kind of embarrassment, don't we, a lot of us? You know, we don't kind of want to get involved, really.
And we feel uncomfortable.
And very
Why?
Often people who need help or need just some kind of a cheering word or message or whatever, I mean, you know, we find it very difficult to do that. I do, certainly. And, you know, that's one of those things. And yet there's a kind of a sort of strange nobility about some people like that who manage to be fiercely independent on their own terms, many of whom at the end of the day don't really want any help or any charity, who enjoy that degree of independence. But I think it's a sort of a mixture. I mean, what the song is about is a mixture of embarrassment, sorrow, charity, and a respect also, I think, for the what seems to me that kind of strange, pure nobility of the itinerant, the lost person who is homeless, who has nothing, no possessions, a very sort of, you know, very pure sort of ascetic kind of lifestyle. So it's a sort of mixture of all those things, really.
As I did walk by Hampstead Fair, I came upon Mother Goose. So I turned her loose as she was screaming. And a foreign student said to me, was it really true? There are elephants and lions too in Piccadilly Circus. Walk down by the bathing pond to try and catch some sun. Saw at least 100 schoolgirls sobbing into handkerchiefs as one. I don't believe they knew I was a schoolboy. And a bearded lady said to me, if you start your raving and you're misbehaving, you'll be sorry. Yeah. And the chicken fancier came to play with his long red beard and his sister's witch. She drives a lorry. Left down by the bus.
black and green, I popped them in there. Four and 20 laborers were laboring and digging up their gold.
I don't believe they knew that I was Long John Silver.
Scarecrow make his rounds in his jet's black Mac, which he won't get back, stole it from a snowman. As I did walk by Hampstead Fair, I came upon Mother Goose, so I turned her loose as she was screaming.
Must have been at least 100 schoolgirls sobbing into handkerchiefs as one.
I don't believe they knew I was a schoolboy.
I think what it's important to see what Aqualung is being part nostalgia for a lot of people, but it isn't nostalgia for me. I don't do it because it's like, hey, it's one of our, you know, great old songs that we kind of go out and just run through. You know, I mean, it's a song we play on stage because it's actually an important piece of music to me. And once in a while, you know, there's some kid in the audience, 17 years old or whatever, who for whom it becomes important, seeing it for the first time, or you know, if it was a new idea or something they're coping with. But I always believed that when people got old, they kind of changed, they became somebody else, you know. But I think these formative years, whatever they are, in my case when I was, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 years, I mean, that was a lot of things went in then, and they're still with me now, which is why I get very concerned and take very seriously what people of that age group, the way they see the band now, or the way that if I talk to them, I mean, I take it very seriously because I realize that these can be very, very important years where a lot of the things that go in there into the back of your head are with you for the rest of your life.
Up next, we'll meet Cross-Eyed Mary. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online 24/7 at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Jethro Tull's Ian Anderson in the studio for the anniversary of Aqualung.
Hello, this is Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull in the studio for Aqualung.
And I'm Redbeard. Everything about the Aqualung album was Ian Anderson's visions, his thoughts on disenfranchisement, the misfits from society, and how they are treated, and also organized religion.
The people in the band at that time were basically people who didn't have any of those sort of views. I mean, didn't really... We didn't talk about stuff like that, you know. I mean, I kept the lyrics to the album really secret until it came to doing the vocals on the record,
because really?
we weren't all talking in those terms or having any common ideas or feelings about it. You know, we were kind of slightly insular, which is why Aqualung as an album, you know, as I said, is one where I tended to shape not just the lyrics and the music, but also to try and build the arrangements and the way the songs would sound as the way I wanted it to be. So it was a fairly selfish album in terms of the way it finally came across. The guys who played on it were playing what I, for the most part, suggested they should play, but also what I thought they would be good at playing and that they would enjoy playing. And some of the things, I mean, the piano work, for example, I mean, John Evans, who just joined the band then as a full-time member, I think he'd, you know, he played some really good things there. Jeffrey Hammond... Literally, he just joined the group for that album and couldn't play at all. I mean, he completely did not play, full stop. I mean, he had to learn to play the bass when we started rehearsing that album. you know, it was an album that was kind of very formative for all of us, although most of the music or stuff of which it was made was coming from me. The end result was, you know, still a band album in the sense that I think the guys had the music to work with that they felt comfortable with at the end of it. But it was a funny one. It wasn't an enjoyable album to make either from a technical point of view, because we went into we recorded two or three things in a particular studio in London. We went to do this one in what was then a new Island Records studio, their own in-house record company studio, and it was teething problems all the way down the line, you know, and it was a wretched sound. It was a real struggle to make this record. Very unpleasant noise kept coming out of the speakers, you know, and you suddenly realise, whoops, that's us.
The Aqualung album by Jethro Tull. That's another brutally honest vignette about the plain but willing girl the Selfish Boys used and then discarded. Part of what made the album so memorable was that it was made up of stories filled with vivid characters, such as
Cross-Eyed Mary.
The ugly girl you see who lives in the, you know, two blocks down the road, who, you know, would never make it, you know, other than the fact she's willing to do things that the nice girls wouldn't, you know, but the pretty girls wouldn't have to. So, I mean, Cross-Eyed Mary is just she's the whore, she's the, you know, the ugly girl, but she's got a good streak about her as well, you know, because she's Aqualung's pal, you know, she's the kind of girl who would be able to sort of say, hey, old man, you know, good on you. So, no, I mean, she's not drawn from any specific person that I've known, but I mean, she's the, you know.
Oh, but we all know her.
Well, you probably, yeah. I mean, you probably did when you were at school. I'm sure there was one in your class at school. You know, the girl who had the really bad acne. Mm. The one who was, you know, you would never want to take to the school dance, but on the other hand, you know that, you know, Smith Minor and Jones had both been seen with her around the back of the toilets or whatever, and she did things the nice girls didn't have to do.
Wondering aloud how we feel today. Last night, sip the sunset, my hand in her hair. We are our own saviors as we start, both our hearts beating live into each other. Wondering aloud, will the years treat us well? As she floats in the kitchen, I'm tasting the smell. Yeah. Of toast as the butter runs, then she comes spilling crumbs on the bed, and I shake my head, and it's only the giving that makes you what you are.
Bass player Clive Bunker had left the band after the Benefit U.S. tour, replaced by Ian Anderson's boyhood friend, Jeffrey Hammond Hammond, who had to learn the bass guitar. John Evans' piano playing, in particular, really sparkles on Aqualung, allowing guitarist Martin Barr to concentrate on searing guitar stings, which punctuated Ian Anderson's pithy lyrics.
But you have to remember that it isn't just me. That it's very easy because I'm the one who does most of the talking and I stand near the front of the stage. I mean, Jethro Tull has not been me plus a bunch of, you know, occasionally changing sort of backup musicians. I mean, it's always been a band, and the band identity has always come through very strongly in writing and rehearsing songs. I mean, I may write the lyrics and the tune, but the way they turn out as arrangements and the sound and the way they come across is always been, I wouldn't say always, but usually, certainly 80% of the time at least, is a band effort, you know? Okay. And the people in the band shape the music much more than I do. I mean, it's down to the people who are in there. And the band has gone through a lot of different qualities of sound, different sort of musical styles and, you know, musical emphasis in one direction or another as a result of the people who happen to be in the group at the time. I play my part. I go with the flow for the most part. I mean, there are some albums where I have been more dominating in the sense of doing the arrangements and really shaping the music in a much more, you know, selfish way, in the sense that I say, this is how I want it to sound, this is how it's going to be. And I mean, Aqualung is one of those albums. Albums like Thick as a Brick and Passion Play, Songs from the Wood and so on, I mean, those are albums very much band efforts, you know, not me at all. I mean, Thick as a Brick was really a group effort, you know.
Really? When these songs were released, Ian Anderson certainly had no pretense about his artistic goals with the Aqualung album.
The actual reality is, at the time I was doing it, I actually thought I was making quite an important record. Yes, I actually really believed when I was doing it that it was really quite a meaningful one. You know, it was. I really thought it was going to be good. I was sort of disappointed with it when we finished it because technically and sound-wise and some of the playing-wise, it didn't live up to what I'd hoped it was going to be. But I had definitely gone into it feeling that it was actually an important record for me to make that, for the reasons I said. If I didn't do it then, I'd probably never have the nerve to do it later on, because it was very much about sort of adolescent emotions, you know, that you kind of, I was worried I would grow out of. I mean, it's something I play now, and I go on stage and I have to, you know, I have a movie in my head that I'm singing the soundtrack to, basically, when I do the song. I mean, I see the pictures and I try and sing the song to, in such a way as those pictures that I see, maybe different pictures to what everybody else sees, but, you know, for me, I'm trying to, you know,
motivate.
Recreate mm-hmm. that song in the sense of an original idea, an original image, which I think I have.
To this day, conventional wisdom of fans and critics alike is that Aqualung is a concept album, in spite of Ian Anderson's insistence to the contrary. To be sure, Side 2 certainly had a theme, beginning with the song My God.
Well, I mean, I just wanted to sing the blues for God, really. I mean, I'm not talking against God or the sort of white man's idea of God. I'm talking here about the, you know, what people have created out of this sort of, this God in terms of all the trappings that go with it. You know, gilded kind of God that we've, you know, sort of, I mean, it has to be actually quite ostentatious and conspicuous in sort of Christianity, particularly in Catholicism. Which I kind of felt was sort of not really what, you know, wasn't the kind of same grassroots level God that, you know, I think most of us would kind of prefer to deal with. So, I mean, it was I'm really singing the blues for God is the simplest way in the world of describing it. It's in a sort of blues feel, blues tempo, and, you know, I'm just saying, yeah.
People, what have you done? Locked him in his golden cage. Golden cage. Made him bend to your religion. Him resurrected from the grave. From the grave. He is the God of nothing. If that's all that you can see, you are the God of everything. He's inside you and me. So lean upon him gently, and don't call on him to save. Crucifix. He's got him fixed. Confuses me as to who and where and why. As to how he gets his kicks. He gets his kicks. Confessing to the endless sin. The endless.
Jethro Tull's 1971 classic Aqualung album. That's the profound song challenging organized religion. It's called My God.
People, what have you done? Locked him in a golden cage, you know, sort of created a sort of fictional, glossy kind of character for this God, and he's kind of locked into it forevermore, you know. Whereas the God, I suppose my idea of God is on the one hand a bit more like the old Jewish God, the Yahweh, the sort of real, you know, the Thor, the god of, you know, sort of war and retribution and everything like that. He's a mixture between that and...
You said Santa Claus earlier.
Yeah, you know, or something essentially much more natural, not personified at all. I mean, something, you know, a blade of grass, a leaf from a tree, you know, a little mouse sitting in a hedgerow. I mean, it's take something between those two extremes. That's what I think about it. But I don't like this idea of formalizing everything into kind of, you know, very ritualistic kind of thing. I mean, it's not just a Sunday phenomenon. It's something that's every day of the week and something you see around you everywhere, you know. And, you know, in your own home, in your own wife and your children, in your garden, in the old tramp at the bottom of the street, you know, sleeping on the park bench.
Coming up, Ian Anderson looks back on the album in the context of current rock history. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Ian Anderson, Jethro Tull's Aqualung.
Hello, this is Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull in the studio for Aqualung.
Thanks, Ian. I'm Redbeard on the anniversary of this landmark release, which has over 7 million copies out there worldwide. But why address religion in the context of rock?
It's that side of the album that seems to contain the God songs, as it were. They go through various explorations of that idea, you know, as to what God is, you know, in the very strange and sort of rather frightening spiritual sense in Slipstream, where it's kind of really a bit, you know, a bit weird and sort of, you know, a bit kind of hippie, you know, a bit sort of a bit weird, you know, through to Locomotive Breath, which is a real sort of aggressive kind of, you know, irrevocable sort of, you know, creator of the universe, sort of going on this sort of so unchangeable route to oblivion, kind of God.
So we're still talking about God in the song "Locomotive Breath."
Oh yeah, I mean, this is the Big Bang theory of rock and roll. You know, this is your Big Bang God. This is old Charlie, who, you know, I'm calling God. You know, old Charlie stole the handle of the locomotive, and the train won't stop going. No way to slow. I mean, it's like the Big Bang theory. It is a universe that is created and can only go one way according to the laws of physics. you know, that's God as well, isn't it? God is the universe. God is this sort of unchangeable set of mathematical and logical sort of, I mean, that is, you know, that's an idea about it. That's another way of looking at what God is.
God nicknamed Old Charlie on the train ride of life. That's Jethro Tull's Locomotive Breath. Bass player Clive Bunker had left the band after the Benefit album U.S. tour, replaced by Ian Anderson's boyhood friend Jeffrey Hammond Hammond, who had had to learn the bass guitar to be in the band. John Evans' piano playing, in particular, really sparkles on the Aqualung album, allowing guitarist Martin Barr to concentrate on searing guitar stings which punctuate Ian Anderson's pithy lyrics.
You can't ever recreate that kind of excitement or that kind of sparkle that happened the first time around. Like a lot of people back then, I just assumed this was a kind of a short-lived phenomenon, and rock music would evolve into something completely different. You know, the pop and rock music of the 90s or the next decade into the next millennium, it would be something completely different. But I now believe that's not the case. I think we actually have absolute values in this genre which are not going to fundamentally change. And when you look at the very close relationship between Blur and the Kinks, or Oasis and the Beatles, or, for example, with bands like Soundgarden and early Led Zeppelin or Pearl Jam and even bands like Jethro Tull. You know, there's not such a great stride being taken. You know, what happens is re-evaluation, repositioning a lot of the same ideas within a slightly different styling, a slightly different musical setting. But, you know, rock and roll, I think, is turning out to be a very finite music form. And I personally don't... I would be very surprised if... in 20 or 30 years from now, there are many fundamental changes in the way that we listen to and enjoy popular music. I think we have something that's probably going to be with us for a long, 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 long time to come. I mean, when Green Day came along, my eyes were popping out of my head as much as the lead singers were, because I thought, hey, yeah, I do that. That's my trick. You know, that's I do that. And then, you know, a whole bunch of little shakes of the head and stuff, you know. But not only that, you know, in terms of a musical style, I'm thinking, wait a minute, this is 1970. This is kind of early Sex Pistols stuff. This is, you know, or indeed the Ramones. So and a lot of things change. The recycling time seems to be down to, you know, in some cases as little as about 10 years, with musical styles and musical types. It was running before that at around 15 to 20 years. It seemed to recycle a whole musical genre within the rock block of musical styles, but it seems to be even shorter now. Anyway, there you go. That's the history of rock and roll in 10 minutes.
Up father high in heaven, smile down upon your son. Yeah, was busy with his money games, oh, his women and his guns. But Jesus said,
Hymn number 43 from Jethro Tull, one of the most prolific album bands in rock history, with 2 5-star albums and 7 4-star albums in the AllMusic.com ratings. Jethro Tull still has not been voted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, even though the Aqualung album ranks at number 337 on Rolling Stone magazine's top 500 albums all time. You can write to me at redbeard@inthestudio.net. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest, Ian Anderson. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2016, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.